Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Maria Sundar Ginetti, who is Professor of Finance at the Stockholm School of Economics. She is also a CEPR Research Fellow in the Financial Economics Program and a Research Fellow of the ECGI. She studies how formal institutions, such as investor protection, and informal institutions, such as culture and social norms, affect corporate finance, investor behavior, asset valuations, and economic and financial integration. Welcome, Maria Sundar.
Thank you for having me, Gil. So I assume you want to talk about production network and supply chain risk.
So I know that you have a couple of new papers coming out. So I was going to start with the paper that's also a recent paper, just a few months ago. Supply chain shortages, large firms, market power, and inflation. Mm-hmm. So in that context, you say here in the abstract, we suggest an equilibrium mechanism for a widely debated argument that greedflation has mm-hmm. Fostered widespread price hikes. You say here we construct firm and industry level measures of supply chain backlogs and delivery delays, and provide evidence that supply chain shortages lead to a decrease in competition at the industry level. So I always wondered about this, Maria Sundar. It seems like, I don't know the exact numbers, but something like five or six firms has 30 or 40% of the market cap in the S&P 500 in the US. Post-COVID, their concentration seemed to have increased substantially. Mm-hmm. It's always a worry, right? When there's less competition, there are a lot of issues around it. So this paper and the other papers that you're coming out, what are they finding?
So let me take a step back and tell you a bit where this paper come from. With the pandemic, it has issues related to supply chain shortages, supply chain uncertainty have become widely discussed in the media. And in general, I had a long-term interest in production network, whether they are stable, what are the financial arrangements, and so on. So I started studying supply chains and the supply chain uncertainty. And I think that a crucial aspect that has not been touched in the literature is how supply chain uncertainty and supply chain shortages affect industry structure. Because we cannot think that all firms are affected in the same way. Okay, so for instance, in a paper that has been just published in the Journal of International Economics, what we document is that when there is uncertainty about the supplier's ability to deliver the inputs, there is a more vertical integration, meaning that firms and some firms acquire their suppliers. These firms end up performing very well, but we don't know what happens to the competitors of these firms. So this is something that the paper on inflation that you just referred to starts to touch upon. So we use industry geographical area measure of delivery times by suppliers. So we know when the suppliers of a given industries have a problem in delivering the inputs. And we use an intuition that is has been used in a lot of papers of production networks and is pretty intuitive. That is, typically firms tend to favor their larger customers, meaning that, you know, larger customers are harder to replace. And to some extent, having a good relationship with a larger customer is also a good way for a company to enhance its reputation. Now, in the moment in which there are shortages, companies may continue to favor their larger customers. So what we observe is that the largest companies in an industry are affected less negatively by supply chain shortages. Mm-hmm. From a theoretical point of view, the way in which I think of this is that well, if there are supply chain shortages, companies won't be able to produce with the optimal input mix, but the largest companies will be closer to the to their optimal input mix than the smallest company. What does that mean is that, well, the larger company might be larger because they were more efficient, but this efficiency gap becomes even more pronounced when there are supply chain shortages.
Yeah.
So what would happen to the industry equilibrium? Well, it's pretty intuitive that production would become more concentrated. But also, since the largest company face a smaller competitive threat, they can increase the price even if their cost didn't increase as much. And this is precisely what we bring to the data and test.
Yeah, it's a bit problematic, if I understand this correctly, Marisa. So concentration, industry concentration sort of perpetuates through the supply chain, meaning if the supplier is preferring larger customers then presumably has an advantage. And so it's not only the production system, it's also throughout the entire supply chain that concentrations happen, right? And then you mentioned, if I understand this correctly, there are sort of mergers and acquisitions going on, both horizontal as well as vertical in the supply chain. So in some sense, for large firms, the shocks are very good. if I were the CEO of a large firm, I'm actually looking for some sort of a major shock to the system where I can pick up market share, I can increase prices, and become more profitable. I'm a bit cynical here, so I just want to...
Some shocks are... indeed good for the largest companies. And which are these shocks? Are shocks that by construction affect them asymmetrically. Part of it is the behavior of the supplier. That is, and indeed we can show in the data that the customers of the same firm have differential performance when there are these industry level shortages. And in particular, the largest customers perform better exposed. It is also that these superstar companies match also with better suppliers. So to some extent, you know, there is a sort of matching. So it's natural that a superstar company is matched to another very large supplier that is also less exposed. So overall, at the end, the shock is smaller for them. And it's not only this favoritism, they also did something right, okay? Yeah. But as of your, so what we find when we look at the industry level is that when these shocks occur, is what happens depends on the initial industry structure. Industry in which there was a more asymmetric size distribution that we capture using the Erfindahl index, okay, become more concentrated. And these are precisely the industry in which we see a higher increase in inflation when there are more supply chain shortages. So on the good side is what we observe is that while the effect on market shares of the superstar firms appear to be permanent, okay, we don't see that they revert, we observe that the effect on their profitability dies down after a few years. So it looks like that there is a competitive pressure from a potential entrant that erodes these profits.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking, Maria Sunde, so from a supply perspective, this is also sort of a risk management question. It's also sort of an optimization problem. So suppose I, as a supplier in the middle of the supply chain, I have constraints on materials, could be raw materials, could be components coming into me, and then I have to put that together and supply it to my customer. And when I have constraints on my supply side, I might tend to prefer larger customers because it's sort of a lower risk for me, right? And so is that happening?
So we don't test explicitly this channel, but it might be part of the reason why firms prefer their larger customers. Said that, what we can show in the paper is to what extent the exposure to these supply chain shortages is related to firm size or rather to financial factors. Hmm. And for instance, there could be larger companies that have a high leverage or a high cost of funding, low cash. And we don't find that subsumes our effect. So the way in which we interpret this, and this is based also on the previous literature, is that, you know, if you have a larger customer, it's very hard to substitute. And these create a bilateral bargaining that for which you end up favoring these larger customers. So perhaps you have done some investment to satisfy the larger customer need, or, you know, larger customer is 30% of your sales, you cannot think that you would find other customers. And
yes, I wonder what, you know, what are the policy implications here? So, you know, if industry concentrations are bad for society, policymakers should try to reduce industry concentration because it then filters into prices and inflation, as you say. And so in a shock, are there policy ideas that we could implement?
So first of all, I want to clarify that the industry concentration is not necessarily bad. A company okay. can be particularly large because it's more efficient. So from the point of view of society, what is less desirable is that markups are high. Okay. In the paper, we provide some evidence that when these effects are at play, indeed, markups increase. Okay. is so these would tend to suggest that these effects could be bad for society. And for sure, what we can say have not been positive for the way in which economies have replied to the post-COVID pandemic because of the inflation shock. Now is how much should policymaker be worried about the presence of superstar firms in an industry? So we cannot fully answer this question, meaning that it could be that in the absence of superstar firms, the industry disruption would be even larger. Hmm. What our theoretical framework and our empirical analysis so far suggest is that well, in an industry in which all firms are equal, yes, the cost would increase, but would increase equally for all companies, okay? So we would see some pass-through of the cost shock, but we wouldn't see an increase in profits of some companies, and we wouldn't see an increase in concentration. Okay, so in this respect, more similar companies will be more desirable. But this paper is really more positive. I mean, it is describing the evidence and why we observe that the largest companies have been having so much higher returns than a smaller company, why we observe higher inflation in some industries. Okay, from the point of view of the suggestion for the antitrust authority, we just we have to wait for more research. So as I was saying, is we have been analyzing in other work how company react to supply chain uncertainty. And in that work, what we observe is more vertical integration. Again, that work suggests that the company that integrate vertically are better off. We didn't analyze yet what happens to the competitors that lose as suppliers. Okay, do they continue to get their deliveries or not? Again, that is something that we plan to analyze in future research. But from the point of view of the policymaker, what we have produced so far indicates that you know, production networks are important, and there are many shocks that can affect negatively production network. So, for instance, one other example is climate shocks. Natural disaster cause a lot of disruption, okay? Yeah. And this is sort of an operating shock for a company, and a company becomes less reliable with the customers. So customers might decide that they don't want to purchase any longer as much from companies that are exposed to climate shocks. What we show in another paper that is actually forthcoming in the Journal of Financial Economics is that the firms that are hit by natural disaster and also their suppliers upstream try to improve the stability of the supply chain by by providing a more short-term funding to the customers of the affected firms. But of course, what we observe is that when the affected firm is more financially constrained and has more financially constrained suppliers, then the production network collapse and sales decrease, and not only for the affected firm, but also for its suppliers. So it's very important to consider that the firms are interlinked when we evaluate an economy response to economic shocks.
So I was wondering, do you find a relationship between sort of the concentration, the measure of concentration in an industry, and a subsequent, as you call, greedflation effects.
Yes, we do.
So, okay, so you know, my intuition is that I don't know if I'm thinking about it correctly. So, if I have 100% of the market share, I'm the only firm. There will not be much effect. I'm just speculating here. Or if I am a very small, it's very fragmented industry, it's very difficult to see any effect. So it's some sort of an inverted U-shaped phenomenon, right? Somewhere in the middle, the concentration effect really makes a huge difference.
So the concentration effect makes a good... So you're right that the mechanism that I described shouldn't have an effect in an industry with only one company. But industry with only one company, they don't reflect much of the reality. And in any case, they are not in our sample. Okay, so what we have in the sample is industries that differ in the size and distribution of firms. So we typically, so we work actually with all the firm level analysis is done with listed companies that are larger per se. So all the results that are described, we rather estimate a lower bound because there are many smaller companies that do not enter in our sample. Okay, so basically is the effects that we we can do it with normal measure of concentration, but another way to think of it is that when these supply chain shortages shocks occur, is industry in countries in which there are these huge firms that are often called superstar firms, experience larger inflationary shocks. And to give you an effect, an idea of the economic magnitude, what we estimate during the COVID period can explain about 24% of cross-sectional differences in inflation between U.S. industries.
So about a quarter of the inflation that we measure,
precisely,
if I understand this correctly, is related to concentration effects?
Yes.
And so that again goes back to sort of a policy question. You know, so we have, you know, sort of price gouging laws and, you know, things like that in the U.S. Mm-hmm. One could argue in some sense this is price gouging in a shock, right?
Well, yes and no, in the sense that this is an oligopoly that experiences a shock, okay? So it is true that in setting quantity and price, these larger company internalize that, well, now there is less competition. Either our competitors cannot produce as much or they have higher costs, they will be less aggressive, okay? So I think that if we go back to the policy implication, is there is one that is more direct, that is a central bank. When there are cost shocks that affect the industries that are relatively more concentrated, should be more concerned about the effect on prices. And the other is that for antitrust authority, when evaluating mergers, they should be considering this other possible shock that might not be evident ex ante. Okay, one may say, well, there will be a very large company, but there are many other competitors. But if this is an industry in which there could be supply assurance concerns because in the future, well, this industry could become much less competitive if these kind of shocks are likely in the immediate future. I think that this is as much I feel confident to say from the point of view of the policy implication.
Yeah, so that's very really interesting. So if I understand this correctly, antitrust implementation, if something doesn't fit the criteria today, and post-shock, they might fit the criteria because your research shows that we can now anticipate higher concentration, right? So you could become more proactive in terms of how you think about antitrust, potentially.
Yeah,
and it's definitely a universal phenomenon. This is, it's happening in the EU, it's happening in India and China, places like that.
So our data are mostly from US and other advanced economy. And when I go and look at the inflation effect, this appears to be mostly an advanced economy issue. And in particular, the results are strong for the US, the EU, but in the moment in which we go to emerging market, we don't find much. Now, it could be different in industrial structure, emerging market were differently exposed to the shocks and so on. But there is not much there. It could also be the sample because in our sample, emerging market are much less represented. So.
Yeah, I mean, India is a sort of an interesting case here. There is very high concentration in certain industries there. Not just industries, but also sort of, you know, wealth effects. 5% of the country holds, I don't know, 90% of the wealth of the country or something like that. And so this in some sense pushes to the other extreme that I was thinking about, which is, if I own 100% of the market, I'm not going to see any effect. I'm not really particularly concerned about a shock. I wonder if some of the but emerging countries have very high concentrations that it, you know, this phenomenon doesn't affect them.
Well, it could be, but the superstar firms and the increasing concentration have been widely documented for the US, okay? Yeah. And partially, even though it's more debated, for the EU. It could be that there are industries in emerging economies that are much more concentrated, but I think that there are also a lot of small companies, a lot of informal, a large informal sector that could actually be largely exposed. I think that to some extent, when analyzing this question, when one first approach the problem, we start with international data, and then we can go deeper with more establishment level data at the country level. And I think that we are currently a bit behind in exploring emerging market data. And we also have to consider, for instance, that the situation in China and the level of demand has been very different, right? China has a deflation, and so we couldn't expect to find something related, notwithstanding all the shocks going on. And yeah.
So I was also wondering, the superstar firms, as you call them, they should have an incentive to engineer supply chain shortages, right? If it is of advantage.
Well, You know, in IO, what you have in mind is related to vertical integration and foreclosure of competitors, meaning that theoretically, when two companies integrate vertically, is they may induce the suppliers of which now they have a control not to deliver any longer inputs to their competitors. Now, many people have explored this issue and the evidence is mixed. Okay, so for instance, for the US, Chad Severson and co-authors haven't found any evidence of this. But there is other evidence that when cable TVs integrate with the content providers, then foreclose their competitors.
Yeah.
And so on average is... this effect doesn't seem to be there, but it's possible that if there is too little of some inputs, then this foreclosure is what is at work, but it's something of which we don't have any evidence so far. And is another area that is, I think, exciting for research on this topic.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm being very cynical here. So, if I'm a large firm, and suppose I create a very large warehouse space, and I buy, let's say, 5x the volume that I typically buy from my suppliers, and essentially I create a COVID-19 supply chain shortage in the system, that could wipe out a lot of my smaller competitors, so to speak, right? I mean, if I have the resources to do that, and I don't know if there's any law that prevents me from doing that. I mean, I could just amp up my purchases without any issue, right?
Sure. I mean, of course, that is expensive, right? You need to have the warehouse. You have to pay for the purchases, and your competitors don't have to be able to substitute those inputs, right? So I think that is, if we consider all these constraints, probably in normal times, this is this doesn't happen. Is that the same idea that to drive up out your competitors, you might want to charge for a period extremely low prices, right? And we know that these things happen only in very exception. So the price dumping happen only in very exceptional situation, but it's very different if some suppliers go under or companies cannot use any longer suppliers in some part of the world because of the geopolitical risk, or if regulation related to environmental policies or other labor policies of potential suppliers cut out the suppliers from a certain part of the world. Okay, so part of these interventions are a bit also protectionistic, but they could backfire with higher prices for the consumers because they create shortages. That is, at the end, there will be some companies that, yes, benefit, but I would think that is very expensive for the companies to create these shortages. So, So, I mean, to go back to the way in which we have started this conversation, of course, gridflation is a very catchy term, okay? And would... But at the end, we are talking about shocks and equilibrium. And I think that is more useful to think of how an economy and how an industry answer to a shock rather than thinking in terms of some larger company being evil. So to some extent, in the abstract, we try to connect to this debate, but you know, we don't really don't think in terms of greed. We think of optimal response to a shock that affect an industry equilibrium. So
So I want to go into a completely different topic, which is other paper. Central bank liquidity reallocation and bank lending, evidence from the tiering system. You say here we document that the reallocation of central bank reserves towards banks with higher liquidity needs fosters credit supply, exploiting the ECB's tiered reserve remuneration system. For identification, we show that the system encouraged banks with low reserve holdings to obtain more reserves through the money market. So that's very intuitive. But before we get into the details of this, so how does the banking system work? What is the reserve? Why do they need it? And how does it affect the whole system?
So let's do a step behind and let's connect to a debate about monetary policy implementation that is currently very heated on both sides of the Atlantic. So during, after the global financial crisis, and of course, after COVID and in the response to COVID-19 pandemics, there has been quantitative easing. What does that mean? It means that the banks increased their balance sheet dramatically. Doing what? Well, they were buying assets, and that's what we have been focusing on for a lot of time. But buying bonds, treasury, and so on also means that these banks created the reserves. This is basically liquidity cash that is held by banks, okay, by regulated institutions. And once the central bank creates it, they have to hold it. Now, of course, the banks have always held the reserves, but these were the minimum reserve requirement. And why? Well, banks funded themselves with deposits, so they are subject to the liquidity shocks if someone wants to withdraw their deposits, or if a firm to which they have issued a credit line, so they decide to use the credit line. Okay. But now banks are investing a larger part of their assets in reserves. Okay. Yeah. And basically what the central banks are doing nowadays is that, well, they want to shrink their balance sheet, okay? And there is a debate about how they should shrink it and how much they should shrink it. And this has never happened before because this was the first time we saw quantitative easing. And there are some that say, well, we shouldn't worry. The banks have always operated without so much reserves. So this can just be done relatively quickly. But then it is a question to what extent banks' demand for reserves has changed and whether decreasing too much the liquidity in the banking system could have also real effect on the economy because a bank shrink their lending. And this is precisely what we analyze in this paper. So let me give you an intuition about why would the bank care about having reserves? The asset holdings of a bank include loans, then there are security bonds, and then there are reserves. And the reserves is the safest asset that a bank can have, okay? So if Silicon Valley Bank had held the reserves on its balance sheet, wouldn't have gone under. The reason why it went under was that, well, the value of the very safe treasury it held went down. Okay, the nominal value of reserves is fixed. So since these reserves are an extremely liquid and safe assets, they could be complementary to loans, meaning that up to a point, they can ensure banks from liquidity shocks. Okay, so this is the benefit. Okay, what is the cost of holding reserves? Well, since they are so safe, they typically have a lower return than the other security, the bonds that a bank can hold. So those are also liquid. It's something that you can sell if you have a liquidity shock, but you know, their value can fluctuate, okay? So basically, the way in which we think of it is that the asset composition of a bank will also depend on the bank cost of capital. Some banks are safer than others and have a lower cost of capital. So basically what we observe in the data is that when the European Central Bank flooded the banking system with reserves, most of these reserves ended up being held by banks that were very safe and had a very low cost of capital. Mm. And this is intuitive, right? Because this bank could fund the asset side with a lower interest rate and found optimal to invest a relatively larger fraction of their portfolio in reserves. The issue is that you can think of reserves as having insurance. Once you are insured up to a point of your portfolio, that doesn't matter any longer for your lending policies. Mm. So the story that the other side of the medal of the story that I'm telling you is that where there were some banks in the euro area that had a higher cost of capital and found optimal to hold less of these reserves, but then they were relatively less insured and decided to lend less, okay? So what did the ECB do at some point? Well, during the period with negative interest, with a negative policy rate, banks that were holding holding reserves were actually paying a negative rate for the reserves, right? Because these were like deposits. So at some point, the ECB, in order to mitigate the negative effect on bank profitability, provided some exemptions for the negative rate that were a multiple of the required, the minimum reserve requirement. So basically, there were banks that had decided not to invest as much of their asset in reserves, for which the marginal return on central bank reserves increased.
Right. Sorry to interrupt. So if I understand this correctly, Marisol, so there is a regulatory requirement to have certain amount of reserves. Mm-hmm. That is proportional to your lending portfolio.
It's proportional to your deposits.
Okay. So if I have excess reserves as a bank in my portfolio and ECB goes out and, you know, gives out, or not gives out, but provides higher levels of liquidity in the reserve mm-hmm. arena, and it is sort of uniformly distributed across the system, basically, some of them actually now paying negative interest, as you say, because they already had enough reserves. And some of them actually required it that would improve their lending posture. And so there's a differential effect. Is that what the tiering system did? Is that how they managed it?
So let's do a small step back. When the ECB issue reserves, someone has to hold them, okay? And then is, of course, banks to trade in the interbank market. Okay, if a bank wants to get rid of reserves, it can basically pay back a loan. Okay, yeah. So it decreases the amount of some other liability, has less cash, and now there is the lender, the other bank that has more reserves. Okay, so is these reserves is like the cash in the economy flows to whoever wants to hold it. Okay, so that's and in general, so what we want to understand in this paper is that does having more reserves lead to more bank lending, right? Yeah. And this is hard in general. Why? Because banks choose optimally how much reserves to have, right? So, you know, it could just be that a bank has some lending opportunity and therefore wants to, this is something that is going to be harder, expose you to more liquidity shock. You can sell loans. So increases the reserves optimally and sell some securities. So what this ECB did is that for some banks that had ex-ante low reserves, it increases the marginal return in on holding reserves. Yeah. And it's unsurprising that this increased the demand of for reserves of these banks. Okay, so that's so basically we use the amount of exemption that the ECB granted to the banking system, and the fact that some banks didn't have enough reserves to fill their exemption, to instrument for this exogenous increase in the reserves. Okay, once we do that, okay, then we can ask whether banks that increase the reserves because of their policy lend more. Okay, and this is precisely what we find. Okay, so basically we have a policy intervention that creates a more even reserves distribution and leads to more bank lending.
Yeah. And so now, as you say, when you want to reverse this, you want to essentially take liquidity away. The same sort of phenomenon exists, right? So some banks are holding excess reserves. Yeah. They're willing to provide that.
Yeah. So this is why is this important for the quantitative tightening in which all central banks are currently engaged? Well, is quantitative tightening means that reserves in the aggregate decrease. And what my empirical analysis tells you is that we don't know what's going to happen. Because if when the ECB or the Federal Reserve Boards sell back the asset and withdraw this liquidity, they withdraw the liquidity from the banks that are super cash rich. Nothing is going to happen, okay? Mm-hmm. Because as we say in the paper, those banks had already reached a saturation point, so they were overinsured. But if in doing this, they withdraw the reserves from banks that have relatively little, well, these banks would have decreased bank lending and the effect would be contractionary. And what is concerning is that quantitative tightening is based on market operation. So there is no way that the central bank knows from which part of the system these reserves will come. Okay, so this makes the effect of quantitative tightening extremely unpredictable.
Yeah, so that is really interesting. So if there's sort of a cross-sectional distribution of banks in the economy, it's very highly varied in terms of their reserves and their lending portfolio. If it's highly varied, the quantitative tightening is sort of like a hammer. It's looking for a nail, and it's going to, you know, hit every nail that it can find. What you're saying is that it's not going to have sort of a consistent, predictable answer.
No, it's very hard because, you know, the central bank decides, well, now I will sell some assets, right? By selling some assets, get some payments from market participants. And that payments is basically will be reserved, so that go back from the central bank. But the central bank is just selling the assets, but doesn't know who is going to buy it, and yeah, therefore from where the reserves will come in. So is something that just through quantitative tightening cannot be controlled.
So is it a timing? Is it a timing issue? That it's a bit like siphoning water out of a tank, and we don't know where the water is going to come from. But at some point, everybody is going to provide that, right? So is it a timing issue?
No, not really. Is a matter that is where the liquidity comes from, and that is is a cross-sectional issue. So that's is a bit you know, when we think of the economy, is we can it's as if we take out some water from a barrel, right? And we cannot say that whether the water is from the bottom or from the top. It's just some water that then, you know, and there will be a lower level. But what Marisol suggests is not only the level that matters, and a lot of discussion in the policy debate have been on the level, is also the distribution.
It's a distribution,
and, I think that to some extent people have looked at the effect of this uneven distribution for volatility in short-term money market. You might remember that in September 2019 there has been this very short crisis for the Treasury, right, with the yields of U.S. Treasury increasing a lot. And part of the reason is that some banks were not willing to lend their reserves. Okay, so there was even if there was so much liquidity around, there was a scarcity of liquidity for part of the system. But what my result is saying is that this doesn't matter only for short-term money markets. So that is easier. Perhaps for a central bank to influence, okay? Yeah. You can just lend yourself. But it might matter also for corporate credit and for whether quantitative tightening can have a recessive effect, okay? Is because we, in general, the central bank wouldn't want the quantitative tightening to be transmitted. It just wants to shrink its balance sheet.
Yeah. So if I understand this correctly, Maria Sundar, I'm not sure I do. So a policy intervention, both tightening as well as easing, quantitative easing or quantitative tightening, the net effect that you will see in the economy is a function of how varied the banks' balance sheets are. Mm-hmm. And so when you siphon out water or you put water in, you just look at the macro level of that, mm-hmm, you may not get what you are looking for. At some point, you might get it, but there is potentially a big lag between an intervention and actual effect on the economy.
So what I am saying is that for a given contraction in the level of outstanding reserves, We might observe that nothing happened to bank lending, and this is precisely what the central banks would want. Or we might observe that there is a contraction in credit to the economy. And this would depend on whether is banks that, yes, have excess reserves, but not so much of them, are basically surrendering these reserves and getting back their some securities, or whether it is banks that are extremely cash rich. For them, it doesn't matter. That wouldn't affect the lending policy.
So what would you suggest from a policy perspective? You know, suppose you want, you know, quick effect of quantitative easing or quantitative tightening. How will you go about it?
Well, okay, for quantitative easing, we wanted the quick effects. So basically what we wanted was that long-term interest rate would decrease in order to stimulate investment and the economy. The reason why central banks use the quantitative easing is that we were at the zero lower bound. So the European Central Bank decided to break the zero lower bound and to use negative rates. The Federal Reserve Board didn't do so, and had only quantitative easing, that is, was purchasing securities to increase the security price and decrease their yields. Right, that was the effect, the way to affect the short-term and long-term interest rate. Okay, now with quantitative tightening, what ideally central banks would want is to shrink their balance sheet without any possible effect on the economy. Okay, so for this reason, one way to have a very slow quantitative tightening is just, let's just get the security mature, and then the central bank will be reimbursed, and that's when the reserves shrink, right? So the central bank wouldn't want anything to happen. But the debate is, but if we shrink too fast and too much, will something happen? Because now banks have become used to operate with a higher level of insurance, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can envision some sort of an elasticity. If I understand the cross-sectional distribution of the system, I can presumably compute some sort of elasticity, some sort of response function. And given that the central bank has all this information, they can actually do it, right? Wouldn't they?
So, of course, they can do the analysis I did, okay? And that's without any doubt. What they cannot predict is where the reserves would come from. When the US Treasury is selling new bills, okay, doesn't know where they will end up, okay? That's the main uncertainty, okay? Basically what my paper tells is that central banks should be careful with quantitative tightening. Now that we have a positive and even a relatively high interest rate, all these reserves are expensive. Okay, why? Because these are deposits at the central bank. The central bank is paying a high interest rates. Okay, so is central banks' profits have decreased a lot. Some central banks have even losses. Okay, so that's why the central banks would want to tighten the balance sheet fast. Okay, but this cost for the central bank operation must be weighted against any cost for the economy. So the results of my paper caution against this potential cost for the economy.
Yeah, so this is not in your research. I just asked this. So is the world better off having a singular central bank?
Oh, that's a very good, that's a very good question. So, you know, of course, I am a fan of the euro, not only for economic reason, but also for political reason. But there are many economists and many US economists in particular that are critical of the European Monetary Union. Why? Because, well, if each country has its own currency, then it's easier to respond to shock, right? Is the Greek crisis would have been resolved very fast, right? So a unique central bank would mean a unique currency, and therefore would, you know, there would be too many costs. Said that, you know, the US dollar has a particularly central role in the economy. And the Federal Reserve, of course, has a job to look at the US economy. So I guess that a lot of emerging markets would want the Federal Reserve Bank to consider also their needs.
Excellent. Yeah, this has been great, Maria Sundari. Yeah, thanks so much for spending time with me.
That's okay. Thank you for having me. So it has been a pleasure. So
thank you.